Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Scheer. And before we get started today, I want you to think about something. What are you afraid of? If you're like most of us, you probably have a fairly decent list, from little nagging worries to bigger stuff like concerns about jobs, health, relationships. Well, on today's show, we're facing all sorts of fears head on. We'll visit a group of artists who fear losing their homes and workspaces. We'll crawl into a cave to get a firsthand feel of claustrophobia. And we'll hit a karaoke bar with a Washingtonian on a month-long campaign to tackle her fears one by one. First, though, we've all received startling news. But when public radio producer Steve Lickteig was 18, he received some news that was downright shocking.
Like, I remember I get this news, you know, this very specific news that everything that you were told in your life is now not true. So
this is a scene from Open Secret, a new documentary film Steve spent 7 years making.
You know, why does this matter? I mean, maybe it's stupid. Maybe I don't need to be worrying about it, you know?
It's the mystery you have to figure out. It was a lie. And it was your life.
The news in question, the actual Open Secret, has to do with Steve's birth parents. He grew up not knowing who they were. To him, mom and dad were Mary Jane and Don Lickteig, an older couple who'd adopted him as a child and added him to their brood of 8 biological children.
Absolutely. Name? My name's Steve.
Steve.
Yeah.
What were your parents' names, Steve?
Lickteig. L-I-C-K-T-E-I-G. Don Lickteig and Mary Jane. And they were married here in June of 1946.
Here is St. Francis Xavier Church in southeast D.C. It was Mary Jane's lifelong church until she and Don moved to Kansas, much against her will. That's where Steve grew up. Steve lives in D.C. now, and in the administrative office of St. Francis Xavier, a woman named Marion offers to find Don and Mary Jane's marriage records.
I can't believe he found that so fast.
It was in alphabetical order.
Wow. That's nuts.
We take the documents into the chapel, and on a dark wooden pew, Steve pages through the marriage agreement, Don and Mary Jane's baptism certificates, something called a prenuptial investigation.
I think it was much stricter than, you know, Catholics getting married. I think there was a lot of making sure that everything was kosher, so to speak. That's not the right thing to say.
But the thing is, not everything was kosher, so to speak, when it came to Steve's upbringing. Because Don and Mary Jane were actually Steve's grandparents. His birth mother was Joni, one of Don and Mary Jane's biological kids. Joni was 21 when she got pregnant after a fling with a much older man in Los Angeles. You open your documentary with a voiceover voice by you, and you say, my name is Steve.
And on my family's farm in Kansas, I found out everything I knew about myself was a lie.
When did you actually learn of this lie? Can you take us back to that moment and paint a picture of how it all happened?
My friend Vance, who's in the film, said, I know who your mother is, your sister, Joni. And then my other friend Alan, who was there, was like, yeah, I mean, I've known since I was in 7th grade. And Vance had known since he was, you know, like 8 years old. And Alan says that I just was very still and quiet and like introspective about it. That's one of those moments where people say, oh, when you're told something shocking, you sort of shut down, or that's what happened. Because there's also a photo of me the next day at graduation with my arms around my mom and dad, and I'm like laughing and they're smiling. I mean, they don't know that I know.
When did you tell Mary Jane and Don that you knew?
A couple of months later, I was dating my high school girlfriend, and they basically caught the two of us having sex. This was at home. We thought they were gone for a lot longer than they were. And it was a Saturday night, and I remember the next morning I was asleep in my room, which was right next to our living room. And my mom turned on the TV really loud, and it was a preacher preaching abstinence. And I walked out, and I turned the TV down, and I said, oh, very, very funny. I get it. Did you play this for Joni when she got pregnant? And my dad looked up from his easy chair, you know, and my mom was in the kitchen, and she turned and looked at me. I said, you know, because I know everything. I know Joni is my mom. Did you not give her this lecture? And my mom said, I have no idea what you're talking about. She just kept saying it over and over again. I don't know what you're talking about. And then my dad slammed his arm down on the chair and said, "God damn it, will you just tell him?" And then she still denied it for just a brief moment. It's like, "What? Tell him what?" And then basically she said, "Yeah, okay, it's true." And then I played the typical teenage card and like stormed out of the house. And I tell you, we never talked about it again.
So that's where the open secret comes in. Everyone knew, except for your own family knew. People in your community knew. A teacher is interviewed in the film, some of your classmates, but the information never leaked. And then, is it Mr. Redeker? Is that how you say? Mr. Redeker, the teacher, he says something in the film that kind of explained it, but still, he talked about the rituals and laws of the farm community, and he says, you just didn't violate them.
Yeah, you just didn't violate them. And back then, I was born in 1969. 1987 is when I graduated high school, and this is Kansas, and not backwards by any stretch, but it was unthinkable to meddle in another family's business. And, you know, my parents, my mom mostly, my dad I think knew, everybody knew, but my mom really didn't think that people knew. I think she thought she kept it very well hidden.
Before we move on, I have a million other questions, but you keep calling them my mom, my dad. Yeah. Even after finding out the truth, you still call them mom, dad, and Joni is still Joni.
Yeah. Don and Mary Jane raised me from an infant. And now I have a son. I have an 11-month-old son. It's really hard work. And I was the ninth kid that they raised. I would have to say, despite whatever they kept from me, they have earned mom and dad as a title.
And what will your child call Joni, for example?
Don't know yet. And I will leave this up to him, and I know I have a lot of influence over it, but I don't think I want my son calling her grandma. It may be biologically accurate or legally accurate or something along those lines, but it's not emotionally accurate.
Speaking of Joni, the scenes with you and her are riveting. There's one where she's baking and you're asking her questions and she's kind of losing herself in the recipe as if maybe she doesn't want to answer.
So then you went back to Emporia and started school.
Yeah.
But you didn't know you were pregnant.
Oh, God, no. But I knew something wasn't right. I really did know. Just a second. When mixed, add baking powder and 2 tablespoons of flour.
Really, really interesting scenes. And at one point you ask her, what were you most afraid of? And she answers,
Mom.
Can you talk some more about that fear? What was it about Mary Jane that you think made Joni so frightened?
Well, the stories I remember, and I have some recollection of this even as a child myself, but it wasn't as severe, is that she was volatile. My mom had truly diagnosed mental issues. She had severe depression. I'd venture to say there was probably issues of being bipolar. And I think when Joni found out that she was pregnant, this wasn't going to be a mom who's going to say, Joni, just come home and we'll take care of everything. You don't worry about it. So I understand that she tried to hide it for a while and tried to figure out what she was going to do. And all of her plans were basically foiled by my mother, who stepped in and said, this is what we're going to do.
What's your relationship like now with Joni?
At this very moment, as we talk, it's kind of non-existent. She didn't like the film. She didn't feel that she was portrayed in the right light. And of course, I completely and utterly disagree. And everybody who has seen it from the family and people know her, like, you captured her perfectly. But nobody wants to see that about themselves. Because Joni's good and bad in that film. And she says some really awful things about my mother in that film.
She calls her a con artist at one point.
Calls her a con artist. Wishes that she would just die and get it over with. But I think when she saw the film and heard herself saying that, she was like, oh my God, what kind of person am I? Why would I say that about my own mother? Basically, what I've told myself, I'm just going to give her time to get over it. The reason I did the film was not obviously for fame or glory or money, because none of those things exist. It was a chance to let my family, each person in the family, tell the story without anybody trying to refute them. I respectfully set up a camera and formally said, tell me the story of being forced to keep a secret about something that you didn't want to keep a secret about. And I learned that it was a long learning experience, but I learned that there's a lot of power, and this is going to sound totally cliche, there's a lot of power in telling the truth. And I learned empathy and sympathy, both, I think. But I totally understand my parents now, and I totally understand Joni. And I don't know what I would have done in the same situation. I know what I would like them to have done, but I don't know what I would have done, and I know how hard it was. So there's a reason why you really need to look deeply into why things are and the why people behave the way they do and come out on the other side with a deeper understanding of not only them but of yourself. And that's what happened here.
Steve Lickteig is the director of Open Secret. You can catch a screening of the documentary this Saturday at 5 at the Hill Center at the Old Naval Hospital in Southeast D.C. The film will be followed by a Q&A conducted by Bob Edwards. For more information and to see a trailer, visit our website, metroconnection.org. Sometimes the best way to combat your fear is to face it head on. That's precisely what D.C. resident Molly Kinder did. But she didn't just face one fear. She faced a whole laundry list. Last year, she spent a month identifying the things that freaked her out and tackling each one. She called it Face Your Fears February. And now, as Jessica Gould reports, Kinder's doing it again.
At a karaoke bar in Adams Morgan, Molly Kinder steps up to the mic, blushes a deep crimson, and slowly begins to sing.
Where it began.
Kinder hates singing in public. But to truly understand the significance of this moment, we have to start our story a year ago, when Kinder was watching the King's Speech with a group of her friends.
She believes that when I speak for them, but I can't speak.
You could do it. You needn't be governed by fear.
And we were talking about how much we admired the king for sort of taking on this fear of public speaking. And I just posed the question to my group of friends, what's your version of that?
Now, at first glance, Kinder, who's 6'2" with flaming red hair, isn't someone who seems driven by fear. She calls herself a walking exclamation point. Her friends describe her this way.
Molly Kinder is confident.
Aspiring.
Energetic.
Joyful.
Brave.
I would say she's fearless.
That was Anne Sadek, Tony Sadek, Kelly Keenan Trimble, and Chris Trimble. And Kinder agrees she's done some courageous things in her life. For example, for her work in international development, she's traveled the globe, sometimes stopping in some of the world's more volatile regions.
I've lived and worked in some countries that made my mother nervous.
Closer to home, she helped keep the peace among rowdy D.C. partiers.
I was a bouncer at Madam's Organ Bar in Adams Morgan.
But like everyone else, Kinder says she encounters things that scare her every day.
Whatever these things are that we're intimidated by or we avoid, we hold ourselves back. If we could just get over that, we would open all sorts of new possibilities for ourselves.
So exactly a year ago, Kinder decided to face her fears head on.
Thought I'll just name this Face My Fears February and just take a whole month of slaying fears or putting myself in situations that I'm outside my comfort zone and then doing some deep thinking about what are more of the bigger, deeper fears that I need to take on.
She started by taking an African dance class.
I was like a gazelle next to a lot of very talented dancers. But it was actually not as bad as I thought it was going to be. I really actually enjoyed it. I wasn't very good at it, but I enjoyed the experience.
Even though she hates pictures of herself, she decided to pose for a photo shoot.
And then I took on rock climbing.
Kinder finally asked out a guy she'd had a crush on for years. And when that didn't work out, she decided to go on a date to a blues club in Bowie, Maryland, all by herself.
One of my sort of existential fears is this fear of not finding a partner and not having a family and ending up alone. I think I just wanted to feel that my life was full and that I'm enough. And I think it did teach me that.
In fact, the months that came after February were full of new challenges.
I bought a house. I moved to a new neighborhood. I took on a job in the government that was much more senior. I fell in love after that. And, you know, there's been a lot of massive changes in my life.
And Kinder says the month she spent facing her fears helped make her stronger to embrace those changes as they came.
I almost felt like I had a sword in my pocket and I wanted to go slay these fears. And it was so empowering and so liberating and pretty profound. I feel like it really changed my outlook. It made me a much more confident person.
After all, she says overcoming fear is a learned behavior.
In seventh grade, my parents forced me to walk to the orthodontist and cross Main Street, which is a very busy street, and I cried the entire way. You know, years later, I went on to live in India and Pakistan and Liberia and travel on my own. I've done some pretty brave things in my life, but that takes a lot of work.
So this February, Kinder is facing her fears once again. She's determined to overcome the challenges of home ownership, tightening her budget.
I'm dubbing this February Frugal February.
And tackling her tool belt.
I'm really daunted by the power drill.
Meanwhile, she's stepping up to the spotlight.
Touching you!
And getting ready to face the music. I'm Jessica Gould.
Are you on a mission to face your fears? We want to hear about it. Send an email to metro@wamu.org or visit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/metroconnection.org. After the break, separating fact from fiction regarding our fears of violent crime.
Please keep engaged. Please keep communicating with us and stand ready to work alongside us.
It's coming your way on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU News coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for our news coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today's show is about the things we fear and how we choose to deal with that fear. Before the break, we heard about some very personal fears involving family, love, even power tools. All very different fears, sure, but all based on very real things. But we'll kick off this part of the show by separating fears from reality when it comes to one particular issue. Violent crime. That's the topic of today's On the Coast, in which coastal reporter Brian Russo brings us the latest from the eastern shore of Maryland and coastal Delaware. And Brian joins us now from Berlin, Maryland. Hey there, Brian.
Hey, Rebecca. Thanks for having me.
Sure, sure. So you're out there in Berlin, which I understand is about 20 miles east of the city we're actually going to be talking about today, Salisbury?
That's right. Salisbury is a city of about 30,000 people. Many listeners out there in D.C. might recognize it as a spot they've driven past on their way to the beach in the summertime.
Of course. So what is happening in Salisbury on the crime front?
Well, back in December, I reported on a study done by an organization called Neighborhood Scout that claimed Salisbury was the fourth most dangerous city in the United States per capita. The story went viral, and pretty soon I was getting a lot of calls from Salisbury, including one from Mayor Jim Ireton. He said the results of that study were based on old data.
It's not an issue of being upset. It's an issue of Neighborhood Scout being wrong. It doesn't reflect the current reality that people are living in right now.
Well, I guess that's the big question, right? Does the reality on the streets justify that harsh assessment from Neighborhood Scout?
Well, the mayor challenged me to spend some more time in Salisbury to try and answer that question. So I took him up on the challenge. I started by talking with Police Chief Barbara Duncan, who says one of the main problems is gangs. She says they're infiltrating local schools and recruiting kids as young as middle school age.
In Salisbury, and in most places too, the gang culture is one of kind of a brutal process of acceptance. You have individuals, for whatever reason, as they're maturing through their adolescence, are lacking something. They tend to turn to that culture to fill some type of a void.
And I understand, Brian, you actually talked earlier this week with some young people and their parents. What did they have to say about crime and gangs in their neighborhoods?
That's right. I went to the Stop the Violence Youth Center in Salisbury. It's located in one of the roughest parts of the city. And each night, dozens of kids come there to play basketball, get help in school, or just hang out in a safe environment. This is Lydia Waters. She's a young mother of a middle schooler. And she says she's horrified that gangs are trying to recruit kids as young as 11 years old. But at the same time, she thinks the community needs to be just as aggressive to keep the kids out of gangs.
I mean, in all business sense, if that's the way they work their business, that's the way to do it, is to get them young. But if we reach them young on a positive note and we can keep them locked in, then that'll be just as good. It'll be perfect if we can do that.
Okay, so is the community up to that challenge?
Well, I went out on patrol recently with Officer Matt Thompson. He says police officers really struggle to try to get through to the kids, especially the most troubled ones.
You try to talk with them. You try to be that person that they might want to look up to or talk with, and they just want to have nothing. They want to have nothing to do with it.
Right.
It's almost like it's just some kind of like a teaching that's been brought out.
So after talking with all these different people, Brian, what is your sense of the crime problem in Salisbury? Would you say the public is right to be worried about this issue, or are things improving as the mayor suggests?
Well, things are definitely not as bad as they were, say, in the summer of 2008, when Salisbury saw a huge spike in violent crime. Mayor Ireton says violent crime is down more than 33% since 2009. But Police Chief Barbara Duncan says there's still a lot of work to be done. And she says she needs the public's help.
Are we starting to turn a corner? Absolutely. Is this a critical tipping point for us? It most certainly is. So I would say to them, please keep engaged. Please keep communicating with us. And stand ready to work alongside us.
A lot of people told me that if groups and organizations like the Stop the Violence Center can continue to work with kids and give them options, the city can win the battle against gangs and violent crime. And the kids of Salisbury can stop being scared and start having fun again. And that is what being a kid should be all about.
Absolutely. Well, Brian, thank you so much for giving us an inside look at the fight against crime in Salisbury.
Oh, you're welcome, Rebecca. It's always my pleasure.
Brian Russo is coastal reporter and host of Coastal Connection on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. If you'd like to hear more of his reporting on crime in Salisbury, you can find links on our website, metroconnection.org. School leaders around the country are losing plenty of sleep as they worry about kids dropping out and disappearing from the educational system. For years, it's been hard to get a clear sense of the problem, but as Kavitha Cardoza reports in our continuing American Graduate series, for the first time, the federal government is requiring states to follow a standardized method in determining graduation rates. And many jurisdictions, including D.C., worry the results won't be pretty.
District residents seem to have a pretty good idea of what the city's graduation rate is.
High school, it's probably about 70%.
70?
I'm going to be really harsh and say 70%.
That's close, at least if you go by the district's official rate. Kayleen Irizarry is the assistant superintendent of elementary and secondary education in D.C. She says the district's graduation rate is 76%, slightly higher than the national average. If you break that down,
for D.C. public schools, it's roughly 73%. The charter schools, about 87%.
But that's not exactly a true picture of what's going on, because until now, D.C. has used a formula researchers consider generous. To understand why we might be overestimating the graduation rates, we need to rewind a bit. Robert Balfance with Johns Hopkins University is one of the nation's top experts on dropouts. He says just a decade ago, the percentage of students completing high school was measured using a survey conducted by the U.S. Census, and reports were always positive.
Graduation rate rising, nation goes to 90%, and then you recognize that that was based on a telephone survey that doesn't include people in prison, doesn't include people who don't want to talk to people who call them at their house at night, and also people know that it's important to graduate. So when you would ask them, how many people in your household graduated from high school? Oh, everybody. They're not like, you know, so all sides sort of inflating it and sort of all agreeing like we don't have a problem when we really did.
States can and have inflated numbers for years using different methods. Some estimate how many students they think graduated. Others count GED certificates as high school diplomas, while others only consider 12th graders and don't include students who may have dropped out years earlier. Even for Chris Chapman, author of the annual federal report on graduation rates at the National Center for Education Statistics, the methods used to calculate the rates across the country are dizzyingly different.
We've got the two cohort rates. We've got the average freshman graduation rate. We have a Lieber rate. I'm sorry, I'm pausing here because I'm trying to think. There's other ones that I could describe in English.
While some might characterize the sheer variety of methods a mess, Chapman generously calls it a mishmash. The bottom line is,
the rates couldn't be compared from state to state.
Until now. The new method, called the adjusted graduation cohort rate, requires states to follow every individual child from the ninth grade on until he or she graduates. It takes into account students who change schools and get held back. Balfan says that'll help provide a more accurate picture.
You would see wild celebrations at the end of the year when 150 kids would graduate. And then you would look and say, but they said they have 600 kids in ninth grade. And they're wildly celebrating 150 kids graduating.
Several states have seen their graduation rates drop, including Maryland. Using the new calculation, the state's graduation rate fell by 5 points to 82%. Virginia has been using the formula for a few years. Its rate is 83%. D.C. will report its new numbers for the first time next month, and Irizarry says the rate will fall significantly.
We expect to see about a 20% drop district-wide.
That's for both traditional and charter public schools. It means just more than half of all DC public school children are graduating with high school diplomas in 4 years. For some district residents, this changes everything.
That's a terrible number.
Even worse than I thought.
That sucks. That sucks a lot. It's really not good to hear in what's supposed to be the superpower of the world, right?
The students not counted as graduates aren't necessarily dropouts. Some students may leave school and return. Others may take 5 or 6 years to earn diplomas. According to the latest data available, under the old calculation, DC's dropout rate is 7%. But that rate is expected to increase under the new calculation. Maryland's dropout rate rose to 12%, and Virginia's is now 7%. Irizarry says a child most at risk for dropping out in D.C. fits a certain profile.
Male, Hispanic, a student who has an IEP for special education services.
But beyond that, she doesn't quite trust the data. That, too, is about to change. Irizarry is looking at the new State Longitudinal Education Database, or SLED. In this new system, each child from kindergarten through 12th grade in DC public schools now has a 10-digit ID number. The database has information on a student's date of birth, race, school, grade, test results,
English language learner status, special ed, whether they're a migrant student, and it goes on and on.
If a student doesn't move on to the next grade, schools have to provide specific reasons and documentation. For example, they can no longer just say a child moved to another state or enrolled in private school. They have to have the transfer paperwork.
Have you ever had a database with such detailed information about children in DC?
No, we have not. That's one of the things we're really looking forward to, that it will be the one-stop shop for data around students.
Following individual students is challenging and expensive. Often students don't tell anyone they're dropping out. Parents aren't always responsive. Phone numbers and addresses change. But even with all the challenges of collecting this data, Education Secretary Arne Duncan says it will provide real transparency, which he calls hugely important.
The graduation rates will probably go down. The dropout rates will probably go up. No one wants to see that happen, but guess what? That's the truth. When you have a baseline of facts, we can learn much faster where strategies are helping to reduce dropout rates and increase graduation rates. We can transfer those best practices across states in ways that just haven't happened.
Chris Chapman has worked on dropout data with the National Center for Education Statistics for 15 years. He says the most important thing to remember is behind every statistic is a real student. He's seen how leaving high school without a diploma can lead to a lifetime of struggle.
My younger brother dropped out of ninth grade.
After working for many years as a dishwasher and living in an unheated garage, Chapman says his brother finally completed his GED certificate in his 30s. The first step to reducing the dropout rate might be to finally count those teenagers researchers call America's forgotten children. Because often what you don't count, you don't see on paper. And if it's not on paper, it's as if the problem doesn't even exist. I'm Kavitha Cardoza.
This story was produced with help from Ginger Morehead. It's part of American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, a public media initiative supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to help local communities address the dropout crisis. Today's show is all about fears, right? And we've already met a woman who's listed her fears and is finding ways to face them. Well, up next, we'll meet someone who's found a rather creative way to face just one fear, claustrophobia. To conquer it, she's been spelunking, you know, exploring caves. Environment reporter Sabri Benashour brings us more on this particular phobia-fighting method and tags along with some cavers to learn how they manage when caught in a tight space.
An hour and a half outside of Washington and 60 feet into the earth, I have been abandoned.
Where are you?
Keely Owens is a longtime caver, and she's led us through chamber after chamber, through hundreds of feet of rock.
No, that's impossible. A person can't fit in that.
You want to see?
Oh my gosh. So Keely has just disappeared into a rabbit hole.
It's kind of like Twister. Okay. It's a three-dimensional puzzle you got to solve with your body. So that's the fun part of it.
Then it's my turn.
Here come the feet.
It's kind of like watching a birth.
Here come the feet. We've got feet. We've got knees. There you go. You're in. Oh, you're in the water. Not where you want to be.
We've entered this room through an 8-foot tube in the rock. The room is not more than 3 feet high. For Owens, these tight crawls are exhilarating, and undiscovered, quiet spaces are peaceful and nurturing. But for other people, not so much.
Yeah, they trigger all sorts of stuff. And I've seen people get really disoriented, feel like they're going to fall over. We could be underground and have everything be fine. You know, everybody's happy, everybody's joking. And people would start to... we're going to start heading out now soon. And you could tell by the tone of their voice that it was really like that you needed to be saying yes to that question.
So of all people who would go into a cave, Amber Lehman is maybe the most unlikely. On the second floor of a downtown Boston office building, the walls are all glass and light pours in.
Thanks for coming out. I'm Amber. Come on, let's head back this way and we'll chat.
Lehman is a recovering claustrophobe.
I could not go in elevators above the second floor. If the elevator was packed with 4 or 5 people, I would wait and take the stairs. I would go into complete panic mode. Heart racing, hyperventilation, the whole gamut.
Until one day, a friend of hers suggested she do something about it.
She said, you know, you really should try caving. And she said, you know, it might help with your claustrophobia. And I'm like, you're crazy. I'm not going in a cave.
Lehman passed on caving trip after caving trip after caving trip until finally something possessed her to just give it a try.
I was anticipating completely freaking out and having a panic attack, which I'd had before. A panic attack feels very similar to a heart attack. You think you're dying. When I got in there, my first thought was, what am I going to do if I get stuck? What if I break my leg? What if I break my finger? What if I break a nail? I mean, you know, I mean, anything is running through your head at that time.
But with reassurance from her friends, something crazy happened.
We're into the cave, and I'm doing surprisingly well. Kind of shocked myself. And I found that I actually started loving it.
Not only can Lehman now deal with crowds, elevators, and tight spaces, she helps run a caving club and leads expeditions just about every weekend. But this isn't actually all that strange.
The main treatment for phobias is something called exposure therapy.
Joseph Bienvenu is an associate professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins Medical School.
It involves getting into a situation that you would typically avoid, letting your anxiety be there until it decreases substantially.
He says if people stick with it, start small, anxiety levels will fall.
For some people, if they spend too much time away from the situation, their fear builds up again.
Back in the cave, Keely Owen says the lessons learned 60 feet underground also help her deal with life's problems.
When I'm out in my regular life, which is actually a lot harder to manage than caving, and I find myself in a situation that just, it feels like, you know, it's too small, it's too hard, it's too difficult of a crawl for me to get through. I think, okay, it's okay. Calm down, take your time, take a breath.
It sounds like, you know, a lot of the important things in life can be found in the cave.
That is my whole thesis right there, Sabri. Yeah.
I'm Sabri Benishore.
For photos of caving and links to local caving clubs, visit our website, metroconnection.org. In a minute, a woman who spent 100 hours staring at a photo of a cockroach.
Maybe it helps change that perception that we probably run away when we see it, or I do.
That and more on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Scheer, and today we're talking about fears. The kind you face, the kind you don't, and in some cases, the kind that sort of sneak up on you. We'll explore that last kind now as we head to Northwest Washington and revisit a spot we featured on last year's Getting By and Getting Ahead show, 52 O Street Studios. The converted warehouse in Truxton Circle has been providing artists with affordable space to live and work since 1978. Out of 30 units, 8 are rented as living spaces and 22 as commercial art studios. Ray Leith is one of the commercial tenants. You might remember her from our original story. During today's visit, she's adding light blue touches.
Is that a pastel you're using now?
To a large figure drawing.
It's called New Pastel, which has just a little bit more binder in it, so it kind of holds its shape a little bit better.
When we met Leith last May, she was prepping for 52O's annual open house and was counting her lucky stars that she'd nabbed such a spacious, sunny, relatively inexpensive art studio on the first floor. But now, 9 months later...
I'm kind of into this blue. It must be my mood.
Things are different.
I definitely think my work is changing. I just feel a little bit more, you know, just a little bit more tumult in the work because of the anxiety of the situation.
The situation is this. In early January, 52 O Street's landlord, Marty Yeomans, sent an email to all first-floor tenants.
Totally out of the blue, saying, it appears that most of the first floor will be vacant by June 1st.
Yeomans plans to convert most of the first floor into a youth hostel, one geared toward artists, he says, with 2 art spaces, a poetry stage, a coffee bar, as many as 40 beds. Ray Leith says the email ruffled more than a few feathers, including her own.
Honestly, my heart went down into my feet. I just went, oh, God.
Because she's been renting her studio for 6 years now, and like most other commercial tenants at 52O, she's on a month-to-month lease.
And that allows the landlord to do anything he wants with the rents and to ask us to come and go as he pleases. So there's no stability.
Hence her current blue period.
Commercial tenants tend to have no rights.
Especially commercial tenants with month-to-month leases, says Susan Bennett, a professor at American University's Washington College of Law.
Really, their leases are only protection. And in the event that the owner wants the space back, then it's very, very tough to assert anything if all you do is work in the space. That's hard.
On the other hand, if you're a residential tenant in D.C.?
It's absolutely the opposite situation. Even if you have only an oral month-to-month lease, residential tenants do have significant rights in the District of Columbia, and they have the right to appear in court and to contest the reason for their eviction.
Hi.
Hi.
Emma?
Yes.
Rebecca.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Back at 52 O Street, first floor resident Emma Jaster hasn't yet contested the reason for her eviction, though she has consulted D.C.'s Office of the Tenant Advocate.
Who said, well, actually, as things currently stand, the landlord does not have a right to make me, as a tenant, because I live here, leave.
But here's the thing. Jaster's an actor and dancer who lives with her boyfriend, actor and musician Matt Pearson. And as of April 1st, they'll be going on a month-to-month lease. In an email, Marty Yeomans offered this arrangement in exchange for the promise he wouldn't raise their rent in 2012. As to why, Yeomans writes in his message, no specific reason at all, and absolutely no reason related to you both. But knowing what she does about the proposed youth hostel, Emma Jaster is nervous. And like her neighbor Ray Leith, Jaster has been going through a blue period of her own.
For the last month, I've been losing time on my artwork in order to, you know, look up, well, where would I live instead? Okay, so if I can live over here, then where am I going to get my work done? And okay, if I can work over there, then Matt's going to need a studio space too. Well, we can find a space that we can both work in together. Do we each need to find our own? Does that mean that we're looking for 3 new spaces?
I know we've only been hearing from landlord Marty Yeomans via email so far, but I did meet with him at 52O, and he says given the nosedive in morale around here...
There's been a sea change in the building since this came up.
And given the way D.C. landlord-tenant law works...
You pay, you stay is the policy. You know, it's difficult for landlords who want to make changes to their property.
He may actually delay his youth hostel plans.
I quickly discovered with Ray and with 2 other tenants that live on the first floor that you just can't bulldoze changes, and I really do realize that. I don't want anyone to leave the building unhappy. No one's ever left this building unhappy.
Still, Yeoman says he's determined to charge ahead before too long. Not only would a youth hostel provide much-needed, affordable lodgings to visitors, he says, but it could raise 52 O Street's profile.
This project would bring a lot of people into this building. It would really get the building the kind of exposure that I think it's never had. And I've gotten some positive responses to it from newer tenants who do see this as an opportunity to breathe life into O Street.
Breathing new life. There is so much life in this building. There is so much phenomenal art going on in this building.
And artist Ray Leith hopes it'll keep going on, though she's far from optimistic. In fact, the way the area around Truxton Circle is changing and developing, she fears for the future of all of 52 O Street. And for the many people breathing life into and drawing sustenance from this longtime haven for local artists. To learn more about 52 O Street Studios and about landlord-tenant law in the district, visit our website, metroconnection.org. We're going to stay on the art front now, but we're going to move down to Old Town Alexandria, Virginia, where the Torpedo Factory's Target Gallery is hosting an exhibit called Fears and Phobias, a perfect fit for our radio show this week. So we sent Emily Friedman to find out how some of our nation's finest artists interpret their deepest, darkest anxieties.
This is not an exhibit about fear of heights, reptiles, or nuclear attack. For a show about fears and phobias, it's surprisingly subtle. Subtle, but sharp.
It's a bandage laid out on appears to be maybe a countertop, and there's a piece of tape that the artist wrote, Biopsy Number 2.
Leah Newman is the show's juror. She chose these works out of hundreds of submissions from all over the country. The piece we're looking at right now is by an artist from Georgia named Constance Tolkien. Newman chose this one because it's relatable. Gauze with blood on it and the words biopsy, she says, are enough to send just about anyone's mind reeling into an oblivion of anxiety. Just to the left, Newman shows me a painting of the traditional European toile de jouy. It's a style of fabric you've probably seen before on a pillow somewhere, with country folk frolicking in the meadow.
You know, there's all these really cheerful people in swings and in lovely dresses, basically with guns being aimed at them.
The people holding guns are not in lovely dresses. Some have their faces half covered by bandanas, their guns cocked sideways. Some are in full army fatigues, and some are children in shorts and sandals, all with their guns ready to shoot.
I think it's the sort of the dichotomy of life and the dangers that might exist.
Suzanne Vihel is one of the local artists in the show. She's drawn a cockroach. A huge, zoomed-in cockroach.
The name of the drawing is Ick, and I think that pretty much sums it up.
And since she works in the often slow medium of colored pencil, she says she spent about 100 hours face-to-face with the pest, or at least a photo of it.
I just went online and looked at Google Cockroach and came up with a bunch of photographs. Yeah, no, I didn't have one sitting on my desk.
It's about a cockroach, but she says it's also about all that you miss when you're looking down at a creature from 5 or 6 feet above. Leah Newman, the show's juror, agrees.
We normally probably run away when we see, or I do, when I see a cockroach. So I never get this close. So I think it's helps us confront our fear and maybe make us realize it's not quite so bad.
Another work in the show by Chicago-based artist Ian Muirhead is far less literal. It's a large painting, 3 feet by 4 feet, filled by the face of a man in glasses wearing a totally blank expression.
This came up because my niece, I found out, got herself, she's 11 years old, and she got herself an account on MySpace, and the people that were friending her were middle-aged men.
Muirhead wondered, what could he do about this?
And how can I look at this in my work? So what I did is I researched all the sex offenders that were within 4 blocks of my studio.
And this guy, the one in the painting, is one of them. though you'd only know it if you read the title of the piece, which is the exact web URL where you can find this man's home address and photo. Muirhead has an entire portrait series of the sex offenders in his neighborhood. Most of the time, he says, it makes viewers uncomfortable, which is exactly what he's trying to do.
I had a group come into my studio when I had about six of these paintings done. Came in, immediately started gravitating toward the paintings and the drawing. These are wonderful. These are really beautifully painted. I love these. And so I started asking questions, you know, like, what do you think these have in common? And so, well, they're all men, yeah, and they're all aggressively painted, and it's very exciting. When it finally was disclosed that, you know, these are all sex offenders that are within four blocks of this studio, there were some really upset folks in the room. They didn't want to be close to these images, and they were humiliated that they weren't trying to embrace them. And I thought that was fascinating.
Muirhead says, often we look away from the things we're afraid of without ever really examining them. And yet his painting demands a closer look. As you gaze at it, or another of the 21 pieces of art that make up this show, don't be surprised if you can't stop staring, even though you may want to look away. I'm Emily Friedman.
Fears and Phobias runs through February 19th at the Torpedo Factory's Target Gallery. To get a preview of Susan V. Hell's Cockroach and the other works we just mentioned, check out our website, metroconnection.org. And now, our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit D.C.'s Marbury Plaza and the West End neighborhood of Rockville, Maryland.
My name is April Goggins, and I'm a tenant here at Marbury Plaza. I'm also the president of the Marbury Plaza Concerned Tenants Association. Marbury Plaza is located in Ward 8 off of Good Hope Road, kind of close to the Anacostia Fairlawn area. Marbury Plaza, while not considered a neighborhood in the traditional sense because it's one singular property, to us it's very much a community. From the fact that we were, until this most recent redistricting, were the only part of Anacostia on this side that was in Ward 7. There's also 672 units here, which means at any time there's 1,200 to 1,500 people. We almost make up our whole entire ANC. Marbury Plaza was built in the late 60s, and at that time it was the premier living space for very professional black families. It was the black elite. It was the lawyers, the doctors, the scientists. There's some notable Marbury Plaza residents like Isaac Hayes, who had parties here with people like Marvin Gaye. Driving down or up Good Hope Road, Marbury Plaza kind of sticks out because there's these large brick high-rise buildings that are very different than the rest of the street. It's a nicely manicured lawn in the front with a nice corporate sign. In the springtime, you can see all the flowers. When you walk into both lobbies, you'll see the same. The nice kind of contemporary furniture and paint. But as you walk down certain hallways, you just see what couldn't be anything more than just not caring. The horribly patched walls or holes that have been there forever. Continuous leaks. In a unique sense, the things that we go here are kind of almost like a little city, things that we've been fighting for as a tenant association for the past 5 years. I've met very genuine, down-to-earth, deeply rooted people from every background with the most tremendous stories.
My name is Susan Prince, and I live in the West End in Rockville. We have Montgomery College to the north of us and Maryland Avenue just to the south. I grew up in Rockville in the 1970s, very near to the West End. The convenience is fantastic. It can't be beat. We're within walking distance of downtown and all of the amenities, and it's also very accessible. We're very close to 270, and we're very close to the metro. Right in the West End, we have wonderful examples of historic houses and historic buildings. That's so unusual in this area to be able to, right in your neighborhood, have a chance to visit different eras of history and learn about it. And it's really quite nice.
We heard from Susan Prince in Rockville's West End and April Goggins at Marbury Plaza. If you think your neighborhood should be part of Door to Door, just send an email to metro@wamu.org or visit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/metroconnection.org. And to see a map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Sabri Benashour, Emily Friedman, Jessica Gould, Kavitha Cardoza, and Brian Russo. Jim Ascendio is our news director. Our managing producer is Tara Boyle. Lauren Landau is our editorial assistant. Jonna McCone, Lauren Landau, and Heather Taylor produce Door to Door. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can see a list of all the music we use on our website, metroconnection.org. Just click on an individual story, and you'll find information about its accompanying song. Also on metroconnection.org, you can find our Twitter and Facebook links. You can read free transcripts of stories. And if you missed part of today's show, or if you want to listen to any of our recent shows, you can click the podcast link up at the top of the page. We hope you'll join us next week when we shuffle up some wild cards and bring you a mixed bag of stories. From a 100-year-old piano genius to a gym that caters solely to Muslim women. Plus, our American Graduate series continues, and the accidental cargo that winds up on ships sailing into our local harbors. I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.